Gene Drazel is the most prominent chiropractor in Stumptown, Iowa, a small burg near Fremantletown. Gene comes to us not with pork, but with walleye, an ice fishing story in northern Minnesota. There he learns a lesson that never leaves him the rest of his life.
Long, long ago, 70 years about a long, long ago, I had an experience as a seven-year-old child that I've never forgotten in my life. Well, I take that back. I forgot for a few years until, we'll get to that later. But this was a story about ice fishing. My experience with my grandfather was frightening. He was an immigrant, son of an immigrant, Czech person from Bohemia. And he scared me, quite frankly, you know, but he had some rather brusque ways of teaching things. He would teach me how to swear, for instance, instead of cry when I was young. And boy, was my mother disappointed by hearing that. You know, I'd practice my new cuss words with her, and she didn't think it was a bit humorous. And he had a postage stamp farm that was totally self-sufficient. They had ducks and geese and chickens and a pig or two. And it was just a glorious place to grow up. 12 milk cows and 40 acres. You know, I call a postage stamp farm nowadays. And I got to go fishing up at his cabin in northern Minnesota. And that was fun. That was warm weather fishing. He also introduced me to ice fishing. Well, that's a whole different story. And nor was I equipped with the proper clothing to be sitting out on a metal bucket on an ice on a lake with ice on it. And it wasn't really pleasant. And two times going ice fishing with him was more than enough by my standards. Well, one day he calls me up and said, "Gene, would you like to go fishing up near Brainerd at the cabin? And we're actually going to fish in an ice house out on Lake Mille Lacs, Minnesota." And I said, "Will we be in a shack, like warm?" He said, "Oh, of course, yeah. It's got a kerosene heater, and you can come spend the weekend with me, and we'll go up and do it." Well, I didn't know that he was going to bring along, he was going to meet while he was up there with his neighbor that he had been fishing with for 15 or 20 years. We'll call him Otto. Quite frankly, I don't remember his first name, but he had an accent. But, you know, in Minnesota, we have many different accents. So I was. You know, I'm glad I kept my mouth shut at the time when he was asking me to do this, because my immediate response was going to be, "No way, Grandpa, I don't want to do that. Freeze my butt off on the lake again." Of course, I wouldn't have said it that way to my grandfather, that I was taught to be very polite to. And so when the day came, my mother said it was fine that I go with him up to the lake. And we got up there in late afternoon, and it was getting dark pretty early in that period of time. And so we met with Otto, and so there was going to be my grandfather, me, and Otto. So we drive the 10 miles to Lake Mille Lacs, which is a huge lake. And if you're not familiar with ice on lakes, it is an extraordinary living entity, as far as I can remember, because lakes that big have a compression zone. So the ice builds up along, say 30 or 40 feet off the shore. They have to build a sort of a wooden bridge across it because the ice keeps expanding and growing upward. Well, you know, that was a scary experience. So here it's now dark, pitch dark. And we drive up across that wooden bridge, and there's all kinds of creaks and groaning and all this kind of stuff. And I'm, like, quite frankly, terrified. But, you know, I'm also seven, and I'm not going to show it no matter what. And so we get out there. Oh, and I should remind you, it was 10 below zero out on a lake 40 miles long and 20 miles wide. And oh my goodness. And the ice makes noise when you drive with it on vehicles. And it always sounds like you're going to break through. And our rule growing up, being out on ice in a vehicle, is you always have to have the windows down, because heaven help you, if you ever go through the ice, you're gonna die, because the water pressure won't allow you to open the doors or the windows. But anyway, with all the creaking and groaning and crunching and stuff that goes on, even though the ice was plenty thick enough, was terrifying to me. So we get out to the ice house, and lo and behold, I look up to the sky, and I don't know if it's because I had seizure disorder or what, but I could not stop looking at the stars. It looks like you could reach them and pluck them out of the sky. And a little while later, my grandfather's hand comes out of the ice house, grabs him by the shoulder and drags me in. So, Gene, you're going to freeze to death out there, you know? And so finally I come back to consciousness, you know, and I just thought that was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I never saw that many stars seemingly that close. So we get into the ice house, Otto and my grandfather, Joseph, and so then we light the kerosene stove. Well, I'm glad it was warm, but it was also smelly. You know, it's like, oh my God, I'm breathing kerosene fumes. But anyway, it starts to warm the place up. I immediately trying to show how brave I was as a 7 year old or 8 year old. I think it was 7 or 8 years old, 1952 about. Let's put it this way. I said something I probably should have never said, and that's, I'll chisel the ice for you. You know, chisel a hole in the ice. Well, I had to chisel two, since there was two fishermen there, my grandpa and Otto. And so he hands me this, I think he said it was a remachined Model T axle. And so I got my hands around the, then I was going to start chiseling this hole in the ice. And he says, no, wait a minute. And he ties a leather strap to me and to the steel bar. And I know what he's thinking. He's thinking I was going to throw that down in the bottom of the lake the last time when it goes through the ice into the water. And I said, no, Grandpa, I'm not going to throw it down to the bottom of the lake. No. I'm tougher than that. Or so I thought. So he ties me to it and I start chiseling. Well, what I didn't realize is how thick ice can get. We're talking like 2.5 feet thick. And so you get a fairly big hole at the top, and it kind of gets smaller and smaller because you don't want to have to keep cleaning that ice out of the, that broken ice out of the water hole. So finally I managed somehow, way beyond my normal limit for heavy work, get the sound of the ice changes when you start to get close to breaking through into the lake water itself. And it's just what happened was I took an extra throw or extra lift on that iron pipe and heaved it down into the hole, and it went right through it and drug me right into the hole. And if it had been any wider, I'd have gone to the bottom of the lake. And so here I am, embarrassed beyond words, that I just muffed up big time in front of these two elderly men. And thank goodness for their character, they didn't laugh at me. And you know, to this day, I thanked them in my mind for not making fun of me. But I got my arm out of it. And of course, I was wet up past my elbow. I got the second hole dug out and got the ice out of it. Well, then my job, I kind of realized at that moment that maybe I had been invited to be the workhorse. I'm not sure. They never admitted to it. But anyway, so my next job was getting a coffee can full of water out of the hole in the ice and heating it on the stove to pour it down these 2.5 foot deep holes to keep the little skiff of ice from forming at the bottom. And heaven help you if you lose a fish, you know, and based on just them getting off the hook because you didn't, you know, keep the hole clean at the bottom of the ice. And excuse me. And in the meantime, they're having so much fun. They're laughing and playing and singing and you know, just, yes, there was some imbibing going on, but they never acted drunk. And later they were telling me it was cognac and schnapps and all these kind of things they were drinking. And they were telling tales and just having a good time. Well, in the middle of this, I have my stool leaned into the corner so I wouldn't fall into the hot stove. And lo and behold, I go to sleep. Well, I don't know how long I was asleep, but the interesting thing is that all of a sudden I woke up, not because they were being noisy, but because they were being silent. And I heard my grandfather speaking in a language that I never had heard, which turned out to be French, naming the different communities in France in World War I that the name of the community was the name of the trench. And my grandfather was a truck driver loading ammunition and carrying it to the different trenches. Well, he got done in that language I didn't understand, and it was silent for a long time. Now, to a 7-year-old, 5 minutes probably was like a year, you know, to my thinking. And all of a sudden, Otto sits straight up and says, "Joe, let me tell you what I did in World War I. I was a sniper for the Kaiser, and my job was to shoot ammunition deliveries to the trenches." Silence, silence, silence. Neither one of them moved. They were flickering in the lantern light, and I was trying to figure out the implications of this. And suddenly, Otto sits up even more directly and looks over at Joe, and they're both kind of flickering in the lantern light. And he said, "Joe, I'm so thankful that I didn't kill you." Silence, silence for another seeming eternity. I mean, here's two guys that just admitted they could have killed each other, and one was supplying ammunition so the other could, you know, possibly kill you. The silence went on for seemingly forever. I was trying to figure out what was going on. And then all of a sudden, they start laughing again and drinking more cognac and schnapps, and not another word was said about it. And I'm going, how's this possible? The two guys can be together as fishing buddies for 15 or 20 years, and neither one of them know what the other did in the war. I never heard it spoke of at all in my grandfather's family, and nor did I ever hear him speak about it again. And I never forgot that. And even though I was just 7 years old, I will never forget that. And here I am 70 years later, talking about it, still talking about it. And it had a lasting effect on me. But the interesting thing is, about 11 years later, I forget to sign up for the draft in my Minnesota, you know, town and county. And got fussed at severely. I thought they were going to put me in jail, you know. And then I finally signed up and like I was supposed to. And lo and behold, my draft number was 11. Now, I want you to know that they drafted through the first 150 numbers. Where did that leave me? I wasn't sure. My first wife and I and my small kid, well, he was too young to be negotiating with us. I had decided that my choices were not wide, that there was very, since my church affiliation didn't say anything about being a pacifist or anything like that, I was locked in. And so we started making plans to move to Canada. and my first wife was, hey, you know, I'll do whatever. I mean, this is serious stuff. And yet I was bound and determined. And that's when I remembered that night in that ice house in Minnesota. And that's, is that why I couldn't even think about killing another person? You know, it was like, it was so haunting to revisit that experience from seven, you know, it was a long time earlier. And yet, you know, it affected my whole life. And it turns out in the process of things, they didn't need my number 11 draft number. And I was 4F besides that. I had a damaged heart. So anyway, I had spent 2 years angsting over what I was going to do. I'd finally decided we'll go to Canada and didn't need to, you know, so I was given a reprieve. And that I became an anti-war person who claimed being a pacifist. Now, I don't know if I was, you know, ever approached and had to do it, how I would have decided. But I thought at that moment that I wasn't going to carry a gun no matter what. And anyway, it's you know, I thank my grandfather for drinking cognac that night and telling all the story about, because as far as I know, he never said another thing about his war challenge. My father came along, and he was in the Civilian Conservation Corps, and he was, as he left home. This is an interesting Franklin Delano Roosevelt program, and so the CCC were kids that built things and trails and bridges and stuff like that, and their most of their salary would be sent home. And they would get an allowance, and he was having the time of his life. It's the first time he had been away from home, and he had been farmed out to different uncles and aunts when his mom died in childbirth when he was 10 years old. And but anyway, so he got discharged from the CCC based on his ability then to join up with the U.S. Army Air Corps in Panama Canal Zone. And that's where he spent his time. And ironically, his most important experience, I said, Dad, when were you happiest? And his response floored me. He said, being a cook in the Panama Canal Zone. Well, they were sent over there in wool uniforms, and I mean, it really wasn't a comfortable time. But and I said, well, why was it, Dad? And he had the total opposite experience from my grandfather. He had the time of his life, and he said he couldn't go anywhere without being guarded by his men, because he was baking and making turkeys and stuffing and dressing and chicken and bakery goods, and he had the time of his life. And you know, that's just to point out how different his experience was from my grandfather's. And I'm just real thankful that I got to hear that. So thank you.
part of the Iowa Writers Collaborative, joining the ranks of Pulitzer Prize winner Art Cullen, Douglas Burns, Julie Gammack, Bob Leonard, Laura Bellin, and more fabulous writers. The Collaborative is a network of Substack pages, each writer in his or her own realm, but all linked together. I have created two Substack pages. On the first page, Mary Swander's Buggy Land, you will get transcripts of Buggy Land monologues and interviews, photos, and extra commentaries. On the second page, called Mary Swander's Emerging Voices, you will hear young, diverse voices comment on current topics. Please